Thank you, Mr. Matheny, for joining us here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Okay, so what are we talking about? Start off by talking about, for one, the great world mind.
Yeah, it's kind of like the analogy I use to try to get into the groove of talking about this kind of stuff. It's kind of like there's a tent in the backyard. It's not quite raised yet, so we have to crawl underneath the tent and look for the tent pegs.
Hmm.
And then maybe we can prop the tent up.
Yeah.
The great world mind. Well, there's a lot of different scenarios that can be played there, but the one I'll use as an example is back in the 1980s, there started a phenomenon called the bulletin board systems.
Yes.
And one of the more interesting ones was a network of bulletin board systems that were programmed to call each other up. So that you could do a relay race with information. So if I was to, this was back in the 80s, if I were to send an email to you in New York, say, and I'm in Los Angeles, I would log into one of these BBSs via a modem, and then I would send address the mail, send it off to you, and then what would happen at the end of the night is all the mails that particular BBS or computer had accumulated would then call the next computer over and flop them over to that computer, and then it would start relaying around the United States or around the world. This was called FidoNet.
Hmm.
And what this would do is, theoretically, every computer would call a computer that was not long distance for it to call, or at least not a large toll call, and just keep moving the mail over, till eventually it would reach a computer in New York City that you were on, a BBS that you utilized, and you would be able to download that mail. It's kind of like Pony Express. You literally could send an email to somebody across the world, but it might take a week for them to receive it. Not like the email that we know now.
Yes.
But this was the beginnings of this kind of information sharing, what's called distributed computing. And when I first came into touch with that, I began to think about the fact that, information is so much of what we are and so much of what we know of the world nowadays. And that what we were, in fact, I think maybe doing, whether we knew it or not, unconsciously, is that we were constructing kind of a collective unconscious of the telecommunication infrastructure, which could, in its own sense, be some sort of manifestation of a global collective unconsciousness. And another way I likened that was to some sort of reconstruction of the Library of Alexandria, which we're not real sure what was in that library completely.
Right.
But we do know that in legend, at least, every book that was important or every book that had been written was in this library, and then it got sacked and burned at one point.
Does that mean that somebody actually has, they ransacked it first, so somebody took that information and then burned it?
Right.
Uh-huh.
Right. So, some of the books supposedly survived, some of the books of legend. And, a lot of legend and myth gets built up around these kind of things that we do as humans. How many stories have you heard about the pyramids, and how many stories have you heard about Atlantis and all these kind of things?
Right.
And to me, it's not that important, historically speaking, what exactly happened, because truth is this weird thing that basically history is the story told by the victors. And so we may never really know what completely happened. What's more important is what is the mythic resonance that percolates up from these things. And as I began to look at what was happening, and I was working in telecommunications at the time, and I was looking at all the different forms of communication that were becoming more and more intricate as we began to build this web, and I don't just mean the World Wide Web, but I mean this web of telecommunications, whether it be cellular, telephone, fax, internet, global satellites, on and on and on it goes. As I began to look at this and realize that what we were doing is there's this construction that's going on that we humans do because we're such an artifact-based type of species, this construction going on of something that was representing what we were thinking underneath, even if we weren't saying it out loud. And that's kind of the beginnings of the idea of the birth of the global mind for me. As I began to work with these theories. And then, of course, one of the important things that I read when I was younger that just blew my mind was Hermann Hesse's Glass Bead Game.
Mm-hmm.
And I read it in a different way than most people that I knew read it. Most people read it as a metaphor and an analogy, and it was all of that. But what I began to look at was there was this device or this game that they used, which was never completely precisely described by Hess in this. And I've read our interviews since that he purposely didn't want to describe it precisely in the book, because his hope was that this is an ideal that somebody would latch onto and then try to manifest or execute. And being the egotistical person that I am, I guess, I thought I would latch onto it and try to manifest that.
Okay. Well, rock on, man. Take it on.
Some may call it hubris. I just say the guy wanted somebody to do it.
Absolutely. And so what did you concoct?
What I started working on was ideas of information, and remember at the time as these ideas were evolving with me, I was evolving through the belly of the beast over there in Silicon Valley, working my way through large technology firms. And somewhere in the mid-90s, this concept of something called metadata came kind of to the fore. And what metadata is metadata is a lot of things, but let's just put it in a document format. If you have a document on the internet, and that could be an HTML page or a Microsoft Word document or a PDF or anything like that, there's two levels of information in that document. The first level of information is something in the very top of the document that you don't see when you view the document through the viewing application. So if it's a HTML page, you don't see the metadata when you view the page in the browser. What the metadata does is the metadata is for categorizing and deriving the data inside the document. So what it is it's data about data. And what it does is it describes the elements of the file. You can also have metadata in MP3s. There's metadata in MP3s. And this is how when you, like, say, load an MP3 in Winamp, you notice that there's something that comes up in the little window that tells you what the name of the album that it came from was, what the name of the song is, the name of the artist, the year, and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
Where that's coming from is from the metadata section of the document.
Yes.
And as I began to work on a couple of committees which were defining metadata, which is a way to describe data so that it can be categorized and relativized, which is to say how does this relate to other things. I kind of began to see the world as having varying layers of data, the universe as having varying layers of data around it, and I kind of theorized that, well, okay, what are the Akashic Records, as we've heard them called?
Mm-hmm.
The Akashic Records are metadata. They're metadata about the universe that we live in.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so that they can be, can that metadata be accessed? Because one of the most important things to understanding data sets and data structures is getting the metadata. Can we get to the metadata of the universe? And so I started working out different scenarios using artificial intelligences and whatnot, and I began to progress towards, I'm still working on it, progressing towards some sort of proof, or, you know, I may prove that this is all just, you know, something I dreamed up when I didn't have enough sleep one night, but then again, I may prove that there is actually some validity to this theory, which is there metadata about our daily life, about our universe, about our planet that we can access. And a couple of years ago, there was a theory that kind of came up that I was working with some friends at UCS, at University of California, Santa Cruz, Ralph Abraham, who's the father of chaos mathematics.
Yes.
And he introduced me to the Gaia consciousness theory. And through Ralph, I also met Rupert Sheldrake.
Mm-hmm.
And Rupert Sheldrake has a theory called the morphogenetic resonance field.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the way that data or information is passed on through a species in not necessarily a verbal language way. It can be passed on as genetic information. In other words, what you learn can be passed on genetically. And then there's a resonance field which says, basically, if I learn something and I'm in a group or a pack, that I can, through resonance, pass this on.
100th monkey.
To the other people in my group or my pack.
Yes.
Or the other you know, parts of the group or the pack, whether they be people or animals or whatever. Rupert did his work with earthworms to prove this theory. And that tells me right there that it's a very strong possibility that there is a field of data outside what we know is our normal field of consciousness.
Interesting.
That was what I would term the metadata.
Very good. You know, in looking at metadata and just how it works and being called meta tags over the internet, it seems that it serves as an index. It doesn't. So you're saying by tapping into the metadata of that reflects upon the conscious experience of us or reflects upon the Akashic record, it would just be, in a sense, an introduction to finding the correct spot within this plethora of information. I mean, the metadata.
That's exactly what derivability of data is.
Right.
What you see in standard HTML documents these days on the web.
Yeah.
HTML is kind of a little brother of XML.
Yes.
And we're starting to see XML just now be utilized, although the spec was written years ago. When I was sitting on some of the metadata committees, got was that you can describe every single element down to the left, you know, with people like the W3C and the Dublin Core people. What I really gutter the word, every jot and tittle inside of a file, and make that categorized in a way that is not being utilized on the internet right now. It probably will in the next couple of years. We're going to see XML come on really strong.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happens, what you'll be able to do is you will be able to do something. For example, I can go to a document and I can find every instance of a word inside that document that will be highlighted and show me where every instance of that word is in a document. So let's break it down, quantify it a little bit, and say we're just looking at a page.
Right.
To draw a small circle here. We look at every instance of a word inside of that page, and then what I can do is I can find how that word is relatively linked to other concepts
mm-hmm.
in other books.
Mm-hmm.
So what I have is I have a database then that is relativized. I can read a concept in a sentence. I can find out how that concept is linked into other concepts in other writers' books and what the relative link is.
That is a massive, amazing computational feat
Actually, it's really not. It's not. That's the beauty of things like XML is that it makes it very simple and a very parsable way to do it.
Oh, I'm just thinking about the storage.
And the storage capacity, though, now you're talking.
Yeah. Tera.
When I was working originally with, I can say this now because I'm no longer working for the company. When I started working with this theory, I was the IT manager of a large corporation, Silicon Valley, and I had access to a Cray T3E.
Cool.
So that allowed, and I had two T3s straight into the May West. So I literally built a couple of GatherBots, which are automated intelligence agents that actually go out on my command and get things according to certain profiles that I tell them to get.
Right.
And they were popping it into this relative database and then relativizing it.
Cool.
And what I was doing is I was building this repository of memory that was being overseen by an artificial intelligence that had a personality profile built into it
mm-hmm.
that I could then talk to via the computer, you know, via the screen. I could talk to it by text utilizing some source code from MIT called a chatterbot. It actually had intelligence, and what it was giving me back was things that it knew from the database that it was building off the internet, which was contingent on what I told it to go get. And then I began to see that when you get into the higher layers of this and it gets really, really, really complex, it began to get a little confusing for me as a scientist looking at this because it was hard to discern at what point this thing was starting to make conclusions about relative links between data, and does that constitute some sort of rudimentary consciousness?
Hmm. And did it?
You know, I can go either way with that. I can sit down on a piece of paper and I can give you all the reasons why it could be.
Right.
And I can sit down with a piece of paper and I can, you know, and I can rationalize it away why this could just be some sort of thing that's coming out of a personality AI construct.
Yes.
And it's behaving according to the rules that are set for it.
Yes. Well, it's
but at least we're in a gray area now.
Right. Yeah, I think, yeah, if we could talk a little bit about the idea of machines becoming conscious. I mean, for some reason, I don't think that they, you know, look at me. I mean, I'm talking to a guru of technology, but let me just pop off a little bit. It doesn't seem that a computer could ever become become conscious because it doesn't have any other functionality besides its computational capabilities, and it doesn't have a goal, in a sense. The consciousness and what Homo sapiens comprise is something of actually doing, having an end, a means to an end. And if it is just the furtherance of, let's say, you know, getting a job or even just in getting a job, that's still, the narrative for a Homo sapien is much longer and much broader than what it would be for an AI. So it seems like purpose is something that's very important to the human element, and because technology is an extension of us, it doesn't seem that, it seems like it should, that it would only be a tool. I mean, is it really within our specs to want there to be conscious machines? I mean,
well, I mean, there's a couple of things you're assuming here, which is that the definition of consciousness is necessarily just human consciousness.
Right.
Human consciousness is a very complex thing.
Yeah.
We have cellular level consciousness. We have, you know, we have a lot of things going on that, in this Western rationalized society, we tend to forget. But you know, back in the early days, and some Eastern philosophies recognize this, and I think we're beginning to realize it again, is that consciousness is much more of a holistic process.
Yes.
Which is, I liken it sometimes to human consciousness is nothing more than an eyeball that is raised out of the goo to look back at itself,
mm-hmm.
the goo of the universe. So to not put a narrowly defined term on consciousness, first of all, let's not say that we're trying to liken it to human consciousness.
Oh, okay.
Let's say that we're just trying to get a definition of consciousness. And if nothing else, this can help us define what we mean when we say consciousness, because I don't think we really know.
Hmm.
We throw the term around a lot, and as human beings, we tend to judge. But I have that human beings are probably the stupidest animals on the planet.
Hmm.
And it's my personal opinion, and I say this to a lot of people, and they look at me really weird. It's because I don't carry the reservation that rational Western type of self-consciousness, or even self-consciousness as we know it as human beings, is necessarily the definition of consciousness. There's a planetary consciousness, very obviously. If you want to really know about what's going on with that, there's a guy, friend Roger Nelson, working out of Princeton, is doing something called the New Sphere Project.
Yes.
And he is scientifically kind of trying to prove that there is a global consciousness, and seems to be getting a lot of really good results on that.
But wouldn't that emanate from the conscious elements on this planet?
It would emanate from all the consciousness elements
right.
on this planet, not necessarily just humans.
Right.
And that would, at what point do we draw the line? Are trees conscious? Are rocks conscious? I mean, there's some sort of rudimentary consciousness that's holding them together, even a rock.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a rock has made an agreement to come together as a grouping of atoms and molecules to stay in a certain shape,
yes.
or a relative shape.
Yes.
So, you know, I mean, there's different levels of consciousness, and I don't really have the idea that human consciousness is the end-all, be-all of anything. So to step back a little bit.
Yeah, but come on.
Do I think machines can be conscious?
Yeah.
Yes. Why would I not want them to be?
What would be their purpose to be conscious? What would they think about?
Well, I mean, they would think about the same kind of things that we think about, I believe. What does a cat think about?
Well, a cat thinks about its next meal. It has a purpose.
And that can be actually. I mean, I'm not trying to just say that all consciousness can be programmed, but purpose can be programmed into a bot.
Right, and so once again, our purpose is superimposed on a bot, so it has no—it has really nothing for itself.
You can give the bot its own self-purpose.
Right,
you can define a set of rules of survival for it.
Right.
Which says you need to go out and hunt and gather X amount of things, and it can be anything you want to define. And if you don't bring back X amount of things, then you're not going to grow, and, you know, all these kind of things that you can program into it. So I think what artificial intelligence research is really proving, to me, it's not so much about making the machine alive. It's more about what we learn every day in working with this is more and more about the process of who we are as human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's been a very enlightening and eye-opening process for me to do this personally, and I know other people that have come to the same conclusion, which is by having to figure out exactly what is automated in a artificial intelligence, you kind of figure out how often you're running on robot mode as a human.
Certainly.
And we do a lot. We run on robot mode.
Well, our whole body is run off robot. I mean, you know, we don't have to think about our heart beating. We don't have to think about breathing.
That's the autonomous stuff. But there's even just going through the day-to-day machinations of getting through your day that a lot of times you're not here now.
Well, you know what? I feel like that sometimes just driving on the streets of L.A., just on autopilot.
There you go.
Hey, this is KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM up in Santa Barbara County. You are tuned to Something's Happening with Roy of Hollywood, and this is Radio Alchemy. I'm your host, Evan Ray. On the line, Joseph Matheny. We're talking about the technology, but I want to launch into Ong's Hat, the beginning, because we're talking about consciousness. And this book seems to go into, let's say, a natural extension of consciousness and the idea of being able to access other dimensions. Let me read a little bit from an article that you and Peter Moon wrote. What began as a heretical Islamic sect founded in the early 1900s by black circus magician Noble Drew Ali evolved over the century into a techno-tantric commune whose members managed to escape this befouled world into a pristine Eden, parallel universe, a New Jersey Pine Barrens devoid of inhabitants. And that is what we are talking about with Ong's Hat. This later ragtag group built the egg, a glistening Fabergé-like device that enabled trans-dimensional travel into unpopulated mirror worlds, per Everett Wheeler Graham model. A special quantum tantric feature allowed passage for two occupants while they made love, irrespective of their race, age, or gender.
Yeah, that actually...
That's pretty groovy, Joseph.
that particular article you were reading actually wasn't co-authored by Peter Moon.
Oh, it says by Joseph and Peter.
Oh, really? Huh, that's interesting.
Okay, what should we take on, Peter?
I think that was from the disinformation.com article.
Where was this from? No, it was from a review of your book. Maybe they lifted
it. That's where it was from, though.
Okay, groovy.
So whoever listed it as being for Peter was I'm just setting the record straight.
Set it straight.
Don't want people to get mad. So anyway, you had a question?
Okay. Yes. Okay. Well, let's try and encompass this in what we were talking about. The thing that I wonder about in science, I've gone to these convergence conferences that talk about bringing nanotechnology, computer technology, and medical technology all into the same being, and they're talking about, of course, technology helping people. I know that you're saying that we're kind of Nimrods. But we have built some really groovy things. What is it about the technology of the body? And that's what's so interesting about Ong's Hat, is because these individuals are using, in a sense, externalized technology, but it's within their minds that that they are realizing that they are able to, in a sense, travel interdimensionally. So what kind of technology are you talking about in Ong's Hat? What was this Islamic sect, and how does it parlay into, let me just ask you about that. Are they dealing with is the relationship to technology different than in a sense what you were talking about with AI? It seems like they're using more natural purposes.
Well, they have more natural purposes behind it, for sure. I mean, if we really want to boil it down to the core of what the group is after, it's not so much that they were after parallel universe travel, interdimensional travel. It's not so much that they were into the perfection of technology. What they were really after is they were looking for a place to go start a new society.
Mm-hmm.
And, that stems a lot from the kind of the political and metaphysical orientation of the group, which is to say, probably a bit Luddite, believe it or not, being as techno as they were, and being a little bit 60s counterculture-ish.
Sure.
For sure. Very anarchist, for sure, or at least strongly individualistic.
Yes.
And what they were looking for is they were looking for a place to start over, which is to, kind of exemplify the thing that Timothy Leary used to say all the time, which is you can't start a new thing in an old place.
Hmm.
And if the story exemplifies anything and points out anything, it's that not so much that you need to run away from your problems and all this kind of thing, but basically I think what they're saying is that maybe there comes a time and a place where things become so monolithic and stale and stagnant that you just need to pull the sticks out from under it, let it collapse, and start over.
Yes.
And not being able, not having the power to do that in this universe, then what they endeavored to do was to find a universe where the Earth was just like the Earth is here, only it, no humans had ever existed. So, you know, all the other animals had, not humans. So, you know, I guess it's a misanthropic way to look at the world.
And here they are showing up. It's like, hold it. Well, no Homo sapiens were here before. What are you guys doing here?
Yeah, that's the one part of the story that, you know, the where are they now part of the story.
Yes.
Which is, you know, my suspicion is that they go to the parallel universe. They start this whole new utopian type community, and then somewhere down the line, it might be a couple of years, who knows, they discover that they've taken their problems with them.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, because we're humans and that's what we do.
Okay. So now, in a previous paragraph in this, it says...
you know what let me tell you a joke real quick?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. you know what the big joke is out there? I mean, I know there's lots of people that believe in UFOs and ETs and all that kind of stuff.
Yep.
So the big joke out there is that we're known in the universe... as the people that if we ever learn how to space travel correctly, we'll be the guys that ruin the neighborhood.
There goes the neighborhood. Bebe's kids coming.
Oh no, here come the humans.
Well, you know, yeah, that boy, we can go up a tangent with that, but coming back onto these individuals and their Fabergé like egg. Okay, give us the breakdown. Is Ong's Hat a media hoax? You kind of said that Ong's Hat legend is nothing but a media hoax, but you wrote a book about it. You're talking about a dark side of this story. Give us an introduction and bring us into this. I know we don't have tons of time, but you seem to rip through things just fabulously.
Well, let me just rip through this very, very quickly. Then I'll give you what I know.
Yeah.
What I know is that there was a Ong's Hat is not too far from Princeton, New Jersey University. It's a little white spot in the road in the middle of the Pine Barrens, the Lebanon State Forest area of New Jersey. And in the 1700s, it was a bona fide town. Major form of commerce there was, or manufacturing there was charcoal making. They used to have these big ovens, and they would make charcoal by hand. As progression happened, and charcoal manufacturing became a much more complicated thing that we know now, they kind of died out. And over the time, over a period of time, it kind of turned into a ghost town. The name Ong's Hat came from the 1700s when there used to be a dance club there. And there was a guy who was rejected by a woman and came outside and in frustration, either threw his head on the ground and stomped on it or just directly threw it up in a tree. But somehow it ends up in a tree where it hung. And it kind of, as these things happen, everybody began to refer to that crossroads section as Ong's Hat because the guy's name was Jacob Ong. And that's where his hat hung until it rotted away. Now, let's move along to World War II. World War II, there was a lot of stuff going on that, you know, we have a romanticized version of what was going on in World War II, again, because of the media, mediating our experience of it. But if you remember, if you think back or look back at what was really going on, the United States suddenly became a paranoid nation. They were worried about Japanese submarines on the West Coast. They were worried about German submarines and U-boats on the East Coast. The shipping lanes. Boats were being sunk. All these things were happening. It was like overnight. Suddenly, the military, the United States military, is charged with, we need to get into this war, we need to win this war, and we need to do it fast. We're way behind.
Right.
Rumors were flying of all sorts of things that the Germans had. To this day, actually, some of those rumors seem to be true. If you read the newest book that just came out, which was The Hunt for Zero Point.
Right.
Which actually tracks back, and historically, this is a guy who used to be an editor for Jane's Defense Weekly, shows that, in fact, there was an anti-grav program going on in Nazi Germany after World War II through Project Paperclip. We brought the scientists back that were working on that, and we put them to work at Boeing.
Yes.
Boeing has publicly admitted this now, that there has been an anti-grav program going on at Boeing since after World War II. With the Project Paperclip scientists. So we know it's not just wacky conspiracy theory being cooked up by people with tinfoil hats. Okay, we know that. We know that there was a lot of things that have come out since, and a lot that hasn't, that was going on in that time period. You know, the Manhattan Project was going on. The Manhattan Project was going on, which is the development of a hydrogen bomb, and all these different things that were going on. The military was throwing spaghetti against the wall in a wild attempt to find a piece or two that stuck. They were doing anything they could possibly do, and they had carte blanche to do it. You know, the government said, we're in a state of war. We're under siege. Pearl Harbor's been bombed. You know, ships are getting sunk. Let's get it together. You guys can do anything you want to do. Here's a bunch of money. Go make it work.
Right.
In this environment, you've got some of the greatest minds of their time at Princeton. You've got people like von Neumann. You've later got people like John Nash coming along. You've got these guys working on the Enigma project, which was the using you know, trithemius wheels and different kinds of ciphers to decrypt the Nazi cryptography. And all of this is going on. Now, here's what I know historically to be a fact. On the campus, you couldn't really cut loose because there was a lot of government officials around. What you could do is you could go just not too far off campus to a small place called the Ongsat Rod and Gun Club, which was out in the middle of the Pine Barrens. And that's where these guys used to go and cut up, you know, to blow steam off.
Yeah.
One of the things that I read from a mathematician who was around at the time named Tukey, he said in an interview, it's on the Princeton site actually, he said that there was a period of time where there was some stuff that they were playing with that was in a gray area. And when I say gray area, I mean that they were wondering about the ethics of what they were doing for humanity overall. But, of course, they were in this siege mentality, and the military was driving them to develop all sorts of things that a scientist who's being thoughtful may think is not necessarily the best thing for humanity as a whole.
Yes.
The atom bomb being one of them, of
mm-hmm.
course.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people had a lot of problems with that. But, be that as it may, Tukey said that one of the things that they used to do is they used to write up some of this information and disguise it as kind of a joke. And they would write these crazy little articles for scientific journals under pseudonyms. And, you know, give it crazy names like the mathematics of big game hunting and stuff like that. and they would write it under a pseudonym, and they settled upon a pseudonym, which was a Dr. Pondicherry, and he gave his address as Ongsat, New Jersey. That's where I'm going to leave you with that, because supposedly the brochure for the Ongsat Ashram and the book catalog, which was later put together by somebody named Emory Cranston, predicates its information on this is the story of this cult of scientists and metaphysicians and artists and utopians that got together in this area, blah, blah, blah. Now, if you look at it on the face of it, and if you do, you know, I mean, just look at the information, you can tell some of it is parody. I'll just say that right up front. Some of it is not. You just know. The clues are there.
Yes.
That somebody's got a very big tongue planted in a very big cheek. But that doesn't invalidate a lot of the information that's in there. It just says that it was disguised. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay, so that's what I'll say about that. I'll also say that I have talked to residents of that area repeatedly who have told me that there is and has been a local legend about an ashram that existed and that disappeared mysteriously.
So tell us about Nobel Drew Ali.
Well, I mean, Drew was an interesting character, kind of like Wally Fard was an interesting character.
Mm-hmm.
Mythical to the point of almost not being real, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say that, I don't mean any disrespect. I'm just like, it's like Jesus of Nazareth. I mean,
mm-hmm.
this what we have that's come resonating down through the centuries is this larger than life kind of character, and that's kind of who Drew is, and that's kind of who Wally Fard is. These characters, I mean, I don't know if you know the history of Nobel Drew Ali, but a lot of people actually credit Nobel Drew Ali with being the father of the Muslim movement in the United States.
Okay.
if you look at pictures of Drew, he's usually in a white robe and he has a fez on and all this kind of stuff. But he was a little bit ahead of his time with this kind of thinking. So, you know, I'm sure he suffered quite a bit of fear and hysteria thrown in his direction for some of the things that he was saying.
Was he a part of a secret society?
He was part of a secret society. It seemed to be some sort of, from what I could gather, because it was a secret society, so I can't get too much information about it, but it seemed to be some sort of black Freemasonry
right.
movement.
Yes.
Which definitely, when you read a lot of this stuff, it really reads like the predecessor to people like Malcolm X.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Why does it say that he was a black circus magician? Did he actually perform?
That was one of the ways in the early days that he made a living.
Yes.
So when you say circus magician, basically you mean illusionist.
Right, exactly.
Somebody who traveled around and did sleight of hand.
Oh, very good.
Now, if you know anything about Wally Fard, who's also a main character, or a big character in the story, Wally Fard is supposedly the person who bought the property to start the ashram. And if you look into the history of Wally Fard, Wally Fard is this really strange character, stranger than Drew even, to me,
mm-hmm.
In that he appears and disappears throughout history, in modern history anyway,
right.
Around the United States. He shows up in Chicago, and then, boom, he's gone. And mm-hmm. then, boom, he shows up in Ongsat, and he buys this property and starts an ashram, and boom, he's gone. And he seems to be almost like a Saint Germain-type character, that shows up at the right places at the right time to give the right information to the right people so that they can start movements, and then he retracts and disappears.
There's and a dimensional shift.
You know, and this information about Wally Fard is not what I'm giving you. What I'm giving you is not the Ong's Hat story. If you go out and look it up on the Internet, Wally Fard is a well-known, maybe mythical, maybe not mythical character who has popped up from time to time throughout the history of the evolution of a you know, a kind of a home. What am I looking for here?
Mm-hmm.
Well, again, he's kind of a predecessor of people like Malcolm X.
Yes. Talk a little bit about the Everett Wheeler Graham model of unpopulated mirror worlds.
Well, the Everett Wheeler Graham theory is not about unpopulated mirror worlds, but Everett Wheeler Graham theory is, in a nutshell. Okay. If you're moving through time, and just to use it as an example, not to say that this is the way it works, let's draw a linear line on a piece of paper, and at one end of the line we'll put a dot, and at the other end of the line we'll put a dot. Okay?
Yes.
And the dot on the back end we'll say is 10 minutes ago. And the dot on the front end will say is 10 minutes from now. And somewhere in the middle of that line, we'll put another dot, and we'll call it me or you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you move down that line from then to in the future, you are faced with a myriad of decisions that you can make, therefore making your future. Okay, and I'm sure everybody understands this simple concept.
Right.
Which is, I make a decision. Sometimes it, you know, that you can quantify this so infinitesimally that you can't even get a bead on it anymore. But, you know, just to put a, once again, to draw a circle around it so we can understand it, because that's how we do things as humans. Let's say that I make a decision to get up out of the chair and walk into the next room. And what happens is a engine falls off a plane, comes to the roof, and lands in the chair that I was sitting in. Because I decided to get up out of that chair and walk into the room, I created a universe where I didn't die.
Oh, very good.
From that engine falling on me.
Yes.
Now, what if I didn't get out of that chair?
Okay. That would hurt.
So, now, where does that go? Where that goes is that when I got up out of that chair, when I made that conscious decision, or maybe it was an unconscious decision, to get up out of that chair and walk into the other room, what I in fact did was I created a universe where I got up out of the chair and I walked into the other room. Now, from that point forward, from the point that I got up out of the chair and walked into the other room, there's an infinite amount of bifurcations that could have been taken there as well. I could have turned back around and come in. Mm-hmm. I could have gone to a different room. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
There's all these different decision points that I could have made. According to the Everett Wheeler Graham theory, every decision that could have been made is made. And in each one of those instances, that is a bifurcation that leads to a parallel universe, parallel to this one, where different things happen accordingly.
So even if somebody, like, just decides not to get out of bed, there still is a multiplicity of...
Yeah. It's infinitesimal.
Yes.
It's infinite, actually. It's infinite. According to the Everett-Willy-Graham theory, there are infinite amounts of universes.
And so what does that mean
for... There's a lot of dogma built around different beliefs on, you know, are they infinite? Is there a finite amount? Is there what's called prime universes, which is that, you know, there are certain central universes that other universes bifurcate off of, and blah, blah, blah. So you can, I mean, you know, the doctrine on that is like, it's like getting into Christianity, you know?
Oh, yeah. Well, thick. Yes, yes, very, very thick.
Very thick, yeah.
Now, how does this work into, then, the idea of their Fabergé egg, and so them sitting into this egg, et cetera, how does that parlay into their decision-making model? Does that mean that they can't control where they're going to go because of the infinite, the infinite choices?
No. Actually, what they're doing is they're using biofeedback mechanics, and if you read these documents, you realize that the technology described inside of them is pretty old, comparatively speaking, to these days. But they're using kind of a biomechanic feedback device, and they're also using a kind of yogic concentration method.
Right.
That allows them to basically think about where they want to go, and so they end up there.
But how could they know where they want to go?
Well, that's part of the yoga. Part of the yoga is getting clear on where you want to go.
Is it just through visualization, then?
Visualization. Because if the Everett Wheeler-Graham theory is correct, everything that's possible does happen. If, in fact, there is some sort of observer effect to the creation of universes,
right,
then it's a very simple, it's not even a leap, it's a very simple step then to realize that by visualizing it strong enough, with enough technology and enough consciousness and enough focus behind it, that you can bring yourself there.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, you have to be very careful about what you wish for, what you
visualize. Yes.
Well, you know, this time is just blazing, Joseph. I hate that. So, look, let's talk about your talk. Tell us about the event at the Bodhi Tree.
Okay. What I want to talk about at the Bodhi Tree this time is going to be a little different. I don't really want to talk about Aung San. That book is 10 years old and done. I'm finished with it.
Okay.
What I'm been moving towards for the last couple of years and am now kind of solidly planting my feet in is working with people. And when I do a lecture, it's different than when most people do a lecture. When most people do a lecture, what they do is they kind of broadcast to an audience. This is my thesis. This is the antithesis. Here's the synthesis. Now go tell everybody how bright I am.
Right.
I don't do that. I do what's called an interactive event with people, where basically what I try to get going on is more of a roundtable discussion, because I have as much to learn as anybody else does. But let's throw some concepts on the table and let's talk about them. And one of the concepts that I think is very important to talk about right now is the fact that we seem to be immersed in a media matrix of a sort that seems to be creating our reality for us, or at least shepherding us towards somebody's idea of a created reality. And I don't want to be too conspiratorial about it, but, you know, there are powers that be that would have us think certain ways.
Yes.
Because it benefits them.
Yes.
And what I think that I see happening more and more and more is that people are becoming, as people, monasticized. In other words, you get most of your information, or as I, you know, a lot of times use the analogy of our window to the world has now become a CRT, which is, if I want to know what's going on in the world, what do? I turn on the television, I turn on the news. If I want to know what's going on in the world, I log into the internet and I go, you know. So, what does that really have to do with the world? What you're looking at is you're looking at a media matrix and an information matrix and a representation, and that's good because you're looking kind of at metadata.
Mm-hmm.
Again, to get back to the metadata analogy.
Mm-hmm.
But you're not really experiencing the world, and you're not really talking to other people, and you're not unifying with other people. And so one of the things that's going on right now is kind of a movement that's known as smart mobbing, which is to kind of reverse this monasticized effect of technology back on, you know, back into itself, and to actually utilize the technology to bring people together as groups. And one of the group exercises that they're doing out there right now, which is very cool, it's kind of a performance art thing, but, you know, it's baby steps towards bringing people together, which is a certain time and a certain date you'll get a text message on your cell phone that'll tell you to show up at a certain bookstore in New York at 3 o'clock.
Right.
And everybody shows up at 100, 200, 300 people will show up at a bookstore at 3 o'clock. None of them know each other. They've all been brought together by this technology, this utilization of technology called smart mobbing. And they all get together, and they come together as a group. And they might just do something really stupid, like all jump up and down and make a chicken noise or something. But what it's doing is it's kind of breaking the spell of monasticism. It's, you know, bridging that proscenium that goes on with the media, which is really what is conducive to is becoming more and more sedentary, but also more and more secluded
mm-hmm.
from your fellow human.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've lost the concept of tribalism somewhere mm-hmm. along the line. We've lost the concept of the pack mentality, and we are a pack animal as much as we may not want to think that we are.
No, certainly.
So we have, somewhere along the line, what technology or the utilization of technology has done is it's led us to become more and more separate. And it's also led our experience of each other to become more and more mediated.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why you have, you know, things like online dating and chat groups and all this stuff, which is wildly popular right now.
Mm-hmm.
Which, this really hit me about 2 years ago. I was sitting in my office, and three people were ICQing me at the same time, and all of them lived within three blocks of me. The same time my cell phone's going off, and they're sending other ones that are close by are sending me text messages. And I'm like, why don't we just all get together somewhere, like, you know, in the middle here, and just, like, you know, actually see each other, and, you know, that kind of stuff. And that's when I realized that, you know, there's a whole generation that's come up and another one coming up behind it, which thinks that this is experience, that thinks that this is how you experience life, is through this mediated, you know, sign and signifier type of way of looking, you know, of relating to people.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally, you know, as much as I'm into technology, I personally don't think that's a healthy thing for a human soul. And I also don't think it's a good thing for us, the body politic, because what that allows, well, let's just break it down to what it is. It divide and conquer.
Yep.
Which is, we can be herded around like sheep as long as we do not have numbers represented in groups.
Mm-hmm. Very true.
It's really that simple.
And that whole medium of communication can be manipulated.
And that medium of communication is very manipulated right now, as a matter of fact.
Now, what is the date, dear, and the time?
Oh, that's a good question.
It's August 17th, is it?
Yeah.
It's August 17th from 2 to 6, correct?
Let me just, you know, I don't have the poster right in front of me, but I will in a second. But, yeah, I believe that's the correct date.
Right. August, I think it's a Saturday, August 17th from 2 to 6 at the Bodhi Tree. And we are almost out of time. Let me ask you one last thing. What is the highest, what do you perceive as the highest level of technology created currently by us Homo sapiens? We have quantum machines. What do we got?
The highest level. Now, when you say highest level,
the most sophisticated. Like, what does the Pentagon have down in their bowels or something?
Oh, well, one of the things that just recently popped to the surface over at the Navy, which you can get this online, is the Navy has been working on a synchronicity machine, and what this utilizes is artificial intelligence technology known as inference. And in fact, what they've got a couple working models of this already. Basically, what this can do is it supposedly it can generate a coincidence in quotes, so that you can then predict things that would normally be known to us as a coincidence. You can be able to mathematically extrapolate and predict what certain people will do, where certain things will be at certain times. So that you can have the ultimate smart weapon, which is to say a torpedo that gets shot out of a submarine and knows where to go in such a way that it will meet a ship when it gets there.
Interesting. And so, and there must be some play within that that says that they would also do some behavioral modification, some kind of social engineering.
So the Poindexter, well, formerly the Poindexter-run organization.
Yeah, DARPA.
The DARPA, well, the TIA,
yeah.
More specifically, already has on the drawing board what looks exactly. I don't know if anybody ever saw the movie, the Philip K. Dick story. I'm blanking on the name, but what Steven Spielberg called it.
Minority Report.
The Minority Report. Yeah, we're already seeing the beginnings of the pre-cops.
Right.
We're starting to see that now. What they want to do is they want to put together databases that will be able to profile people based on knowing everything that they do and have done, and be able to extrapolate out and guess or infer what these people would do, and therefore, you know, put these people in jail based on the fact that they show a high risk of being whatever, a terrorist, because that's the word of the day. But, you know, basically because they're not going to play the game, criminal or otherwise.
Wow. So I guess the best thing for all of us to do is become erratic. Just don't show up to work dressed like in a gorilla suit. I don't know.
Become as right brain as possible, and that's how you beat them.
Right.
It's the old trick that a chess master taught me years ago, which was you use your left, your right brain runs your left hand, your left brain runs your right hand.
Yes.
So the way you beat somebody who's really good at chess, I'm going to give away a secret here, is you sit on your right hand and force yourself to move with your left hand. And you will form an attack in chess that will be so intuitive that it will blow away the logical left brain person that you're playing, and they won't see it coming.
Brilliant. Did you guys hear that, man? Joseph, man, you got to come back. We got to have some extended hours of talking about everything you've dipped into, because it is such great fun to try and define consciousness, try and figure out how we can use our first nature senses and communicate without a mediated, manipulated medium.
Mm.
And really appreciate your time. And, folks, check him out August 17th at the Bodhi Tree. It's going to be groovy. You heard it here. So please do that. And thank you, sir, so much for your time.
Thank you.